Well, I was born in Bundamba, actually. It was just a couple of miles away from here. And, well, my first indication of life, if as I could put it that way, was my father was a miner, and he just must have decided in his early life to go to Collinsville, where the state had just opened up a new coal mine. And but the only way to get there was to go by ship, because there was no rail link in those days. That was about 1922, around about then. And I just have a faint recollection of walking up some stairs and getting to the top, and there was a big storm on. This ship was rolling all over the sea. And I could see this going backwards and forwards, you know. Well, I'd be three at that time. And, of course, I shouldn't have been there at all. And one of the seamen must have grabbed me and took me back down into the wherever I came from. That was my first recollection of life. And I grew up, I started school in Collinsville, and sort of grew up until I was about 10 or 11 when my brother and I came back to Ipswich. But I had my early schooling there and early experiences there, which were a bit different to what the way they lived when they come down here. Naturally, I got myself into a bit of bloody bother. I was a pretty wild young fellow, apparently, in Collinsville. Well, you know, just down the road from us, there was a tribe of Aborigines. That was their home territory. That was there. They lived there, and they went on their walkabouts from there and that sort of thing. Of course, I knocked around with the Aboriginal kids, you know. We're in the bush and living in bag humpies, actually. And before they start, before we were able to get a house to live in Collinsville. So I suppose, consequently, I was a bit wild in my early days. But anyhow, that was my first introduction into life, was at Collinsville, really. And came down here, of course. And got to the school. I left school when I was 13, in the Depression days, around the late 1929-30. And got a job working in a sawmill when I was 13. And the greatest bloody place of exploitation of youth and I've ever experienced, I think anybody else has ever experienced, was there. I was working 6 days, well, half a day on Saturday, for 10 and 6 pence a week, and that was $1.05 in today's money. So you can work out how much a bloody, you're working 9 hours a day. That was my first experience. Well, of course, being a little bit rebellious, I just, you know, sort of got up my nose. And I finished up getting bloody sacked, but the boss decided to sack me. I said, the bloody best thing you could do, cheeky little buggy, you know. Best thing you could do, I'll go and get a bloody job where I can get a decent wage. And I won't have to work for you bastards anymore. Oh, he was going to boot my ass and everything. I said, well, come on. I had a big road pack handle in my hand at the time. But he didn't come near me, so off I went home.
So how old were you then?
I was 13. Well, I was 14, actually. Yeah, 14. Anyhow, my grandfather, Charles Kilpatrick, he was president of the Miners' Union. He was the first full-time elected president of the union, actually. And Anyhow, Mum must have had a word with him to think he was home and didn't have a job. And, so he sent word to me to go and see Mr. Walker. He was looking for... And see, all the owners went through the union to get their labour back in those days too. In the mines, that is, isn't it? And so I went to see Mr. Walker. He lived just up the road from where we lived. Actually, I knew him, didn't I? And yes, I got a job for you. Start on Monday. So that's how I come into the union, into the miners' union, or into the mining industry. Worked on the surface for a couple of years and then went underground, where I worked for about 20 years underground. And I was always interested in the union, of course, because I thought my grandfather was the most important man in the world because he was president of the miners' union. Well, this was me, and I used to brag to my friends about it. He was also, he became a member of the upper house in Queensland when it was still alive. And he was one of those, I think they called them the suicide squad or whatever. He was one of those that was elected into the upper house to bring about its abolition. And they did, of course. They were successful in 1922, getting rid of the upper house. So he was also, he was a member of the Legislative Council too. So he was a pretty active bloke himself.
What about during those early years? What were the sort of political influences that you would have had on you as you were growing up, before you started work, and then when you first started work? Was your family sort of interested in politics?
No, not particularly my father. Well, Dad was, I don't think he was ever a member, or he could have been in the early days, a member of the Labor Party. Because Sol Charlie, he was pretty influential in the Labor Party himself. Central committee member for years, of course, or so he became a politician. Dad wasn't, he never spoke a lot about politics. I didn't know much about politics, and I used to listen to people, you know, particularly when elections were coming up and that sort of thing. And I suppose I was about 18 maybe. And I was on the way home from my girlfriend's one night, and I ride, ride a push bike, you know, nowhere other way to get around, never had enough bloody money to go any other way anyhow. And it's a bloke speaking on the street corner down at Bundamba, not far from where I live. And I stopped to listen to him, you know. And I said, Jesus, that's the sort of thing we ought to be doing, you know. He's got the right idea. This, in my humble opinion, he's got the right idea. And one of the blokes came over. He had two or three blokes, you know, with him there, and one of them came over and said, you're interested in politics. I said, well, I don't know about interested, but I'd like to get interested. And I found out bloke was a member of the Communist Party that was speaking. His name was Welsby, Mo Welsby. And he was only about my age, and he was a pretty young bloke at the time, you know. So, but, you know, that happened, and sort of no further contact. They didn't ask me to join the Communist Party or anything like that, you know. And Oh, am I? At work. This was about the same time that this happened, roundabout. And it was a branch election for officers of the union for that particular branch. And I was nominated for president. Oh, I said, oh, God, come on. I said, I'm just a boy. These are all older blokes. I was the only youth there, you know. And, oh, no, they thought, you're president. We'll help you. They didn't want to help me at all. They had to do it all on their own anyhow, so. But anyhow, I was 17 when I was elected president of the branch of the union. And I was an officer in the union from that day till the day I retired.
When you say that the branch of the union, each mine would have had did they call it a lodge?
Yeah, well, they called it a lodge in New South Wales. We called it a branch here, but later on, after my time, it became a lodge here, same as New South Wales. Yeah.
So it was a branch that was based on one of the mines, the mine where you were working.
I worked at. We had a committee, your committee of it, who were chairman, secretary. Some lodges had a treasurer and scrutineers, a group of about 6-7 people who did the look after the affairs of the union in that particular lodge. Anyhow, I got to the stage along the line that I wanted to go further in the union, of course, had that ambition. The party thought I joined the party in the meantime over the years, and well, so, 1942 actually.
Can you tell me a bit about how you came to join the party then?
Yep, a black named Miller, I suppose you've heard of him, Tom Miller, Bluey Miller. He was elected president of the union after, I think it was after Martin Miller died. Well, Martin Miller retired, he didn't die. And my Martin Miller followed my grandfather, who died in 1935. In fact, my grandfather died the day before I started. I was to start in the mine on the Monday, and he died on the Sunday. And Martin Miller became the president. He retired, and Louis Miller won the ballot for president. Well, he came down here, and we knew him. And my father played in the band of Collins where we lived. We lived across the road of them, from them in the bush, if you can call it a road, a bit of a bloody track up through the bush. And they were there, and we were on the other side, living in Berghumpies. And, of course, we were young kids, and the Millers were teenage kids or getting on. They were working in the mine by then, and met their Miller brother. There was three of them. There was four of them, four brothers. And, of course, they just treated us like real family, you know. So anyhow, when Blue came down, we were talking one day, and he said, you know, Diggy, you should be getting yourself involved in politics. I said, yeah, well, I've been thinking about it for ages, but no bugger's ever asked me, you know. Well, he said, I'm asking you to join the Communist Party. I said, yeah, right, I will. So that's how I started. Oh, well, they recruited me. And now, of course, my family, your mum was shocked, you know. Or, what would your grandfather think? I said, well, mum, I thought by now grandfather might have joined the Communist Party himself, you know. Oh! Anyhow, they got over that, and of course, from then on, nobody could say anything about me. You know, people might talk about communists and that, and I said, you know that Digger's a communist, so he's not what you're saying he is. There they are. She used to defend me. But, yeah. So that's how I became a member.
So that was 1942, during the war.
Yeah.
What sort of impact did the war have on your working time then? You were working in the mines then.
Well, I would have joined the forces. No, I would not be in. Not be in the 21. You know, I was only still a teenager. My mother said, "You're not joining anything." You know. Because she was anti-war, you know. People, our young people shouldn't be going to war getting killed because someone else said they should, you know. Anyhow, Mum wasn't up in politics, but she was pretty militant. I tried to join the Navy, but I was colourblind. They found out I was colourblind. I knew I was, but they didn't know until they gave me these tests, and they said, "No, we don't want you. You go home." So anyhow, I was called up then for the, what would they call them? Conscripted. And anyhow, I went up, and they gave me this list of all I had to do. Told all about what was going to happen. I was to be back there at a certain date on, and I had to bring with me, two or three pairs of socks, a pannikin, and an enamel plate, and all the bloody sorts of things that I had to take up there with me, which I landed up there with. And what's your name? I said, "Murphy." "Oh yeah, it's your Murphy. What's your first name?" I said, "Charles McKenzie." Oh yeah, he looked it up. He said, "You're a coal miner." I said, "Of course I'm a bloody coal miner, half Ipswich are coal miners." And he said, "Get back to the bloody work." He said, "We want coal. We want men too, but we want coal more." They just wiped me like a bloody dirty arse. I could have said, "Up you, mate, and gone and joined us," but Mum wouldn't have it. So I remained in the pits. Yeah, go back to the pits.
And you said you worked in the mines for 20 years. What would you have done after that? Because then you would have been about 34, 35.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do after that?
As I say, I had ideas of becoming really involved in the union. I wanted to be a union officer, you know. So the election came up for check inspector. But before that, I said to myself, I'd no bloody education, you know. I took classes at the Ipswich Technical College on mining. They used to run mining classes there for mine managers and that sort of thing. But they also ran a class for mine deputies. I said, well, first of all, I've got to get a deputy certificate. And anyhow, I went to college and studied. In fact, I went to college for 6 years altogether. And, got my deputy certificate. And to be a check inspector, which I was going to do, was my aim, you know, to become a check inspector of the union. You had to have a deputy certificate. So I had my deputy certificate, so I was nominated at my branch of the union for the position of check inspector. And I won it. And become a check inspector.
So what did the check inspector do? What sort of job was that?
Well, he... Yeah, I'll never forget this till I'll tell you something else about that after. But the check inspector went to mines, inspected them to make sure they were safe for the union members to work in. And the branch themselves, or the lodges themselves, they elected their local check inspector in between check inspectors, union check inspectors' inspections. They could determine if there was some controversy about anything safe in the mine, they were the ones that had handled it. Then they'd bring us and say we want a check inspector out there. So, inspected for safety, went right through ventilation. Everything was safe underground as far as roof conditions and all that sort of thing. So it was a general, and there were government inspectors. They used to go around, you know, and periodically have a cursory look at the pit and go away, go up to the mine office and probably have a scotch or two with the mine manager and write his report in the book, you know. And got the check inspectors, we went down, we went, took our local branch check inspector with us and inspected the mine and put our report in the book, and if there was anything wrong, either things had to be fixed immediately or there would be no work in the mine. Well, you know, you sort of gave them that. Those particular areas of the mine, if they're not safe, will be closed as far as their members are concerned. They won't go in there until they're made safe. That was the sort of thing a check inspector did. In fact, the owners used to... one mine manager said to me on one occasion when I said, well, I'm stopping your pit, you know, till you get this fixed, otherwise you're not getting the coal out. Oh, he said, we'll get our inspector out. I said, oh, I'll get your inspector out, will you? And the bastard knew that he'd bloody made a big blue, you know. Get our inspector out. He was talking about the government mines inspector. All the government mines inspectors that I ever knew were mine managers at one time. Mine managers. They weren't workers in the pit, you know. Well, they were workers in the pit of a kind, but they were mine managers. So I suppose this is why this bloke said, well, we'll get our inspector. Yeah, I was a check inspector for 8 years, actually. And there were two of us, two check inspectors used to. And in those days there were, I think there was about 12 working mines in Rosewood and about 20 in Ipswich at the time. And the rest were scattered in places like up around Torbenlea and Maribara and Blair Athol and Collinsville and Mount Mulligan up to northwest of Cairns. They were pretty widespread.
And then after you worked as a check inspector, did you work, what sort of work did you do after that? Did you stay as a union
official?
Yeah,
well, Louis Miller retired in 1964. And the party sort of decided that I should be the candidate, the party candidate for the position of president, you know. I said, I don't know whether I'm up to that or ready for it. They said, well, you should be by now. He went, you've had 20, nearly 20 odd bloody years in the industry and 8 years as a check inspector. So anyhow, okay, so I agreed. I thought, well, yeah, why not? I'm trying to think. There's no other bugger that I know could do any better than me. So, yeah, there was a fair field that ran for it. So I won the position in 1964. And old Blue retired. And I was there till I retired, which was 15 years.
So when you say Blue, he would have been from a Labor Party background rather than a Communist Party background.
No, he was a member of the Communist Party in Collinsville when he was elected.
Just go back to when you sort of got involved in the party. Can you tell me a bit about how that, like, once you joined, what was the actual, what did that mean to your sort of daily life? You would have gone to party meetings, yeah, and so on. Can you tell me a bit about what, being in the party, how did that affect your sort of daily life and your life at work?
Yeah, it affected me a fair amount, actually. And of course, I was always the sort of bloke that if I joined something, I was in it. Boots and all, you know. I just didn't join it for the sake of joining it. I wanted to be, you know, as active in it as I was able. So that I went to meetings. We used to have our meetings, I think, about fortnightly at a party member's house somewhere.
What would you do at those meetings?
Well, they used to discuss all sorts of projects, you know, current problems of the workers in our areas and so on, involve ourselves in party decisions. They used to run classes, political classes, you know. Because our tutors, they were fairly knowledgeable, and they used to, we'd have those during the day somewhere, maybe down on the riverbank, or make it a bit more pleasant than sitting around in a bloody smoke-filled room or whatever. And sometimes, of course, in the house, it wasn't always outside. Yeah, and I run classes on all the ins and outs of communism, what it meant, and what a communist's responsibilities are.
Yeah, so the party would have given you some responsibility as a member? In particular, like, was each person who was, I'm just interested in how the party actually operated then. Would you have been given some sort of responsibility?
Yeah, well, right, not as an individual, yeah, as a group, yes. We of course, involved ourselves in elections. We, from time to time, had street meetings. Somebody would be speaker for that particular street meeting, going out telling the people all about our party work and what communism would mean to, you know, the people of Australia. And in some instances, of course, we got a pretty noisy reception, but in other instances there was a fair amount of support for the party speakers, and we used to have them in town there, in the main street in Ipswich, a prominent speaker from the party there. We had Fred Patterson there on one or two occasions. Some of the other state party leaders at these meetings, particularly right in town, you know, in the city where you had a fair audience, you know. Yeah.
And what about at work, you know, in your union branch, yeah, and so on? There would have been a few of you who were members of the party.
I was the only one at my branch where I worked. I did recruit a couple of the lads there over the years. I was there that came there that got interested in politics. All sorts of things happened over the years, issues would come up. Protests were organised and necessary. We had many days off over the years, protesting about whatever the issue was.
You said that there were quite a lot of mines here, like you said, 12 in Rosewood and 20 in Ipswich. Would each of those mines have a union branch?
Yeah.
And so would there have been Communist Party members in most of those union branches, do you think? Or in some of them?
It was very few. Most of them, actually, we had a branch of the union. There was a few at one time, but they sort of dwindled. Blokes retired, blokes left there, went to somewhere else. That type of thing. And eventually we were flat out having enough to hold a meeting. So the railway workshops, they had a branch of the party over there. So we merged with the railway workshops, became the Ipswich branch of the Communist Party.
Okay. I'm interested in how, the party had a sort of strategy or policy of mass work, of actually getting out amongst the masses.
Yeah.
How did that translate into what you did in your sort of daily life with your fellow workers and so on?
Yeah, well, I was... anything local, yes, we were always there. If there's any big meetings, mass meetings and that sort of thing. We were handing out leaflets and all that sort of thing. I wasn't one of the main speakers at some of these meetings. Well, I'd be there handing out our leaflets and all that type of thing.
Because I'm interested in how you were elected, like you're saying, 1964, you were elected again as a known Communist Party member, to the union leadership. So people obviously saw you as a valuable person to be leading the union.
Well, they must have, yeah.
And even though there weren't all that many communists involved in the union. So how do you think that came about? Does that...
I think the Communist Party, people, I don't know, it appears to me that people realised that communists were people who had the interests of the workers at heart. They did their best as far as their working conditions and all those sort of things were concerned. They were the ones who were doing this, and there were some people who were union leaders, not only in the miners' union, but in most other unions, who did nothing but collect their wages, And I think the Communist Party leadership got a name that it was good for their union. And of course the party itself, they had people who maybe weren't members of the Communist Party, but who were close to the party. And because of their isolation in some of these other areas throughout Queensland, they were always supporting the party and would be sort of organisers themselves. Whilst not being a member of the party, they were organising their own people there. And of course they become people who held branch officers' positions for years.
So there would have been quite a few union members who weren't in the party but would have been supporters of the party.
Supporters, yeah. And
could you take a guess at a proportion of what you know, of those miners who were in the union? Could you take a guess at the sort of proportions of people who might have supported the party? Well,
Pollensville was an exception. They had a pretty big branch of the party up there. Apparently, they were at the, there was a lot of party members up there in the union, you know, union members. In other parts, there were very few. But there are always those people who probably would have been members of the party had they been in somewhere where there was a branch of the Communist Party, and sort of being isolated on their own. You know, they didn't have that opportunity.
Mm. What about your party work outside of your miners' union work, like in the community? Because the party did try and get its members to be active in community organisations and so on. Did you get involved in that sort of thing at all?
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Whatever was going at the time, whatever the issue might have been, whatever the problem might have been, we'd become involved in whatever way it was possible for us to be involved.
Mm.
And it was hard to put your finger on a particular thing, you know.
What about your kids? How did it impact on them, you being a member of the Communist Party when
copped, they
were young?
They copped it from some kids. Some kids whose parents, obviously, were anti-communist. And, of course, that's the only way they would have, you know. And yeah, they come in for a bit of rough stuff, you know, from donkeys around the bloody place. They thought they were being smart, you know.
Because we'd be talking about, this would be the 1950s when there was a big anti-communist push on, wasn't there? You would have been involved in all the struggle around referendum and so on.
My wife would get on the bus, you know, go into town shopping and that sort of thing. We'd be sitting behind somebody or alongside somebody who didn't know who she was, and they'd be talking about these communists, you know. I used to cop all those sort of things.
Did she join the party too?
No, she never joined, no. The only one of the family that joined was Cheryl. But the other two, while they weren't members of the Communist Party, they supported it. And me, especially, they supported me, if I could put it that way, too. So, they wouldn't cop all, you know, some of their friends or schoolmates or whatever they're talking about, they wouldn't cop it there either. And even the teachers, my youngest daughter, she would go to high school. And she came home one day and tells what this teacher was going on with, you know, but obviously an anti-communist. And she said, I got up and I told him straight that he didn't know what he was talking about. My father was a member of the Communist Party, and my father didn't do those sort of things, and my father wasn't anything like what you're talking about. In fact, she said, I told him I'd bring you, my father, up here to school, and you and him could have a debate in front of our class. So that shut him up. He never ever came at anything like that after. I said, good on you, love. And she was the shyest of the lot of them, you know. Yeah, small as Beth. You're the youngest. I wasn't going to get away with that.
What about the Eureka Youth League? It wouldn't have been in existence when you were young, probably.
No, it started somewhere along the line. Yeah. No, I was never in it. It wasn't. wasn't something that was going, you know.
Yeah.
But it was. I think Cheryl and Judy were in for a few years. Yeah, they used to go to meetings down in Brisbane. And, not the Beth, no, she didn't see you. But neither, I don't say neither of them joined the party, but they were supporters of the party, and but they were supporters of Dad too.
And could you summarise how the part, being involved in the party, how did that influence your sort of daily work with your fellow workers? Like, is there a philosophy you took out of being in the party that you could explain how you actually worked with them?
Yeah, well, yeah, it was actually. And explain why people should be demonstrating, why you should have the right to demonstrate, and you should be able to demonstrate if you're not satisfied with what the leaders of our country are doing and that type of thing. Even, you know, work, if the boss is trying to put something on, well, this is not right, you know, we should be doing something about it. And I suppose you always have to give a certain amount of leadership to the blokes to get them thinking about it, what the issues are and what they can do and what they should do. Yeah, I think that was the sort of philosophy that, try to engender into our workmates.
And when you say give some leadership to your fellow workers, what would you see that leadership, how does that come out in practice, being a sort of leading person amongst your fellow workers? What does it involve to be a good leader?
I don't know. I don't know whether I was a good leader or not, but I was in these positions for a long time, so I must have been doing something right. And in fact, you know, the blokes used to say to me, Murphy, you know, you're the best president we've ever had, you know. I said, I'm doing the job that these other blokes ahead of me did. I said, they're the ones that led the way. They're the ones that got us to where we are now, not me. I'm just carrying on where they left off. And that's about what it is, too. The early leaders of our union. Yeah, they had tons of courage, you know, because they had the world against them, sort of thing. Particularly party members who are union leaders. They were always getting bashed by the bloody press. I know I was. All the time I was. There was never... You used to get reporters, newspaper reporters particularly, ringing you up at all bloody hours of the night and day and then giving you bloody heaps when the report came out in the paper the next day or the day after, whatever. And when elections came up, that was happy hunting ground for them. Communist leadership, you know. So they're going to be opposed this year, and it's quite likely they'll be defeated, you know. All this sort of caper. Didn't happen that way, but that's what they were hoping would happen, you know. And the reporters, some of the reporters particularly, were vicious anti-communist bastards themselves, you know. I could have named a few of them, but there were others who were that was their job, to report, and they reported what you told them. Some of these other anti-communist reporters would have some sort of innuendos in it that never happened, and weren't even bloody anywhere near the truth, you know. But and I know the ABC reports, well, they were the best of the lot.
Mm.
they're the best of the lot. They report the bloody thing as it happened, as it, as you told them.
And before, just keeping on about that sort of philosophy you had, before you actually became, you know, before you were elected to the presidency, when you were sort of a rank and file miner, basically, but you were in the party, what sort of philosophy did you take from being in the party about your sort of political work with your fellow workers? Could you give me some idea what you felt? How did the party lead you to actually do political work with your fellow workers?
Yeah, well, I don't know really. It just sort of happened. When I really got to know what the party was all about, you know, that made the difference. I was able to, you know, go, for instance, if I went to a mass meeting when I was a rank and filer, and I knew then what the party was about. I was able to give what support I could in my humble way, put it, uneducated way. But I knew all about it. I knew where we were going, you know. So I was able to give whatever support I could at all these types of events because of their knowledge and my learning from their knowledge.
Mm.
But as I say, it just sort of happened. It sort of grows on you, you know. You know in your own mind that you're right in what you're doing, and you do it to the best of your ability. I don't know whether the best of my ability was very much at all, but I always tried to be honest, and I always tried to do my best as far as the workers were concerned. Particularly the people of our country, but the workers in particular, of course, because they, as I always used to say, well, there's no solution to the workers' problems this side of communism. And some people used to laugh about it, of course.
And you still believe that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I know what's happened over the years, and I know how the people of, you know, the Soviet Union and others were sold down the drain. And I often think to myself, what must they be thinking now? Their country has gone right down just about to the bottom of the ladder with the leadership they've got, you know, and what they had before. And I had two visits to the Soviet Union in my lifetime. And I never saw any beggars in the street. I never saw anybody, you know, in rags and tatters and that sort of caper. That people used to give you the idea that this was happening, you know. And I know they had some problems. They had some problems with shortages of goods that they needed. They used to queue up. There used to be fair queues in some of the shops and that sort of thing, you know. But I never saw anybody who was really downtrodden and neglected. I saw a few drunks, of course, but not many, not many. But that bloody vodka, it was a pretty potent bloody brew, I believe.
Yeah. And if, just to sort of summarise the sort of philosophy you've taken from working as a communist for most of your life, I guess,
yeah,
what sort of thing would you be saying to young activists today? What's the lessons that you've learnt that you really should... they should take heed of, do you think, in their political work?
Well, I suppose you could say that we could all do better than what we are doing. I haven't been active, of course, in the party for some years now, because there is no party in Ipswich. Had there been, I would have still been active in it and still trying to convince people that communism would be a far better system than what we're living under. And now ourselves, you know, particularly when you've got people like Aberdeen, the Prime Minister of our country.
But you would have quite a lot of young people today who probably would be interested in the ideas about socialism,
I'm sure.
What lessons do you think they need to learn to build that movement more strongly?
See, what learnt me a few lessons in the early part of my life was the fact that, my mother and father went through a depression with five kids. And my father was out of work for nearly 6 years and getting the dole. They got the dole for part of that 6 years. They got some rations, food rations. The first part of it, I just forget what value. It certainly wasn't enough to bloody feed kids, you know. And then they started this, you get the dole, but you had to work for it. They worked bloody hard for it, most of them did. My father worked in a blue metal quarry 2.5 days a week, and he got £2.06. That was to keep a family of seven, £2.06. Well, naturally, they got into debt. They couldn't have no alternative. There was a grocer in Mundamba. He'd be probably one of an most exceptional businessman because he never knocked anybody back for what they wanted. They couldn't pay for it. We used to give him, you know, probably 5 shillings or whatever it was, or whenever they could get 5 shillings. And they saw them all through. Never knocked any of them back. He was a wonderful man. And of course, my mum and dad, when dad got work, they started to pay this debt off. They paid it all off, every shilling off. And I've said to Mr. Parrott, well, Mr. Parrott, you're always Mr. Parrott, said to him one day, and when I was talking to him in the shop, I said, you know, about all the money that was owed. I said, but how did you had to pay for your groceries? I said, oh, yeah. He said, oh, we got through all right, you know, we got enough to keep going. And I said, I suppose you still had a lot of debts, you know, that never got paid. Don't believe it, son. He said, almost without exception, everybody come and pay the debt they owed me. Yep. So even those are the sort of things. I used to wonder to myself, why is it that there are people with plenty of money, more than they'll ever need, and there are people who haven't got any and are needing things and are not able to buy the things that they really need, you know? This is what it used to always be. Why does this happen? And this is what, you know, sort of made me say to myself, despite the fact that my grandfather was a big noise in the Labour Party and so on, they're not doing any better. Why aren't they doing, you know, making sure the people are in this country get what they need and need what they need to live. This is what it was about. And they don't do it. And of course the Tories, as we call them, you can expect that from them because they represent big business. So those are the sort of things that boiled up in me, you know, and sort of steered me towards a party like the Communist Party, their philosophy was that people should have the needs they live, they want the needs to live.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, put that side up. It was those sort of things that influenced me that I wasn't going to be in any of these parties where they did nothing for the bloody working class. I wanted to be in some political party where they would, if they were able to, get into a position where they could do it.
Is there some last things you'd like to say about it? Just about what we've been talking about?
I'm not active in much at all these days, being 94, or nearly 95. But luckily I've still got my marbles, so that helps a bit. But I'd just say to people that you should think very carefully about the sort of things that you should be supporting. Think carefully about, you know, what your family, what are they going to grow up into? See, it frightens me a little bit about what my great-grandkids are going to grow up into, but they'll go along with the flow sort of thing, as they say, and that's all they'll know. That's all we knew when I was a boy, it was poverty. Never had a pair of shoes in my life till I was about 14. Think carefully about the type of politics that you should be supporting, about the people who you vote for in elections, the ones that, if there are any, that can do the job that you think they should be doing. There's all sorts of things that you can, you know, that can influence you and just make sure that you give it plenty of thought. The thing I was going to tell you before just come to my mind about the check inspectors and the mines inspectors. We often had to deal with them, you know, when problems arose in some of the mines. And we always didn't see eye to eye with bloody, you'll gather that, but with the mines inspectors, I knew them all. You know, I used to have to go to their office and discuss things with them and that sort of thing. Go and see the chief inspector for coal mines, who had an office in Brisbane, the mines department, and have discussions with him about different things. But I remember having a discussion with the chief inspector one day, and I wasn't getting on too well with him. In fact, I was getting a bit annoyed. And talking about check inspectors, you know. And I don't know how it actually came up, but the check inspector's duties, you know, I'd say a check inspector's duties are to go to a mine and inspect it, to check on government mines inspectors. That's why they were called check inspectors, to check on your people. Oh, well, Christ, didn't anybody get up in the air? And I said, well, that's a fact. That's how it came about, whether you like it or not, you know. And as I said to him, what else could they be? I said, they're all bloody mine managers before they become inspectors. But that he was a check. He was the government inspector at the time, like name Rates, Bill Rates, and he got the act changed. See, check inspectors were meant. It's an act of Parliament, because the government paid a big portion of the check inspectors' wages. And we got free train travel and that sort of thing, you know, or car travel sometimes if we had to. And he got the act changed to eliminate the check inspectors and put in district union inspectors. That's how much...
So he had the name changed.
Yeah, that's how much I must have upset him. Tell me, his inspectors being checked by union inspectors. Oh, of course, he wouldn't have that. But it was true. That's the only reason I had him. In fact, my grandfather, when he was elected to the position of president, full-time, he became president check inspector. So he was actually the first union check inspector. Yeah.
You mentioned about the 1949 coal strike. So how did it impact on you blokes here? Were all out on strike.
Oh, yeah. 6 weeks we were off, out on strike, yeah. Actually...
Because Chifley brought in the troops to try.
Yeah, the bastard put the bloody troops in the coal mines. Yeah.
And did that happen here to all the mines?
No,
here?
No, didn't happen here.
So the mines here were actually closed for that 6 weeks.
Oh yeah. Yeah, 6 weeks of strike lasted. Actually, the pit I worked at, and. They had the same ownership had three other mines, and we went back to work. The strike was over, and the manager confronted us and said, "There's no work for you, Murphy. No work for you, Campbell. No work for you, Spencer. No work for you, Pocock." The four main leaders of the branch committee, me, the communist, these other three, they weren't members of the Communist Party, but I was their influence, of course. So no job for them. They were the poor militant bloody workers, you know. So we held a meeting. I told the lads there's no work for Murphy, Campbell, Pocock or Spencer. Well, they said there's no bloody work for us either. There's no work for us until you bastards get your job back. So, same the three other mines. The same thing happened. So we were out for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before they capitulated. Yeah.
So they actually gave way and you got your jobs back.
Yeah, went back to the bloody, you know, and I said to the manager, I said, "Well, give me a bloody good reason why. You gotta have a reason, haven't you?" He didn't know what to bloody say for bloody. He said, "You're bored with the particular part of the mine you worked in. That was your bored, your cold face, you know. Your board's, it's finished, it's, I said, but there was nothing wrong with it when we went out, there was still bloody, plenty of coal, it was all coal face, it was still there in Spresses and bloody Pocock's, and it was finished, yeah. And that was the only excuse, our board was finished. Anyhow, we went back, of course, and, we had another three or four weeks, yeah. Yeah. One was up in Saline, and of course the scabs went in up there. It was bloody warfare, nearly gunshots. Up there, just the police avoided it. But, up at Saline, and the other one was...
So this wasn't army people going in it, they actually got recruited some scabs to go and...
No. They were farmers. They were bloody farmers.
And they recruited them during the main strike?
Well, no, not during the main strike. This is when this was... well, it may have started when the... I wouldn't be too sure about that. So long ago now, of course. I think you might be right. I think they might have put the scabs in before the actual strike finished. Yeah.
And so the miners who were on strike actually took up some arms to try and fight them, did they?
That was the bloody farmers who had their bloody guns ready. Yeah, no, it wasn't our fellow. But there were a few bloody fist fights around the place.
Mm-hmm.
Down the pub especially. And they all got a few grogs under themselves. One bloke, he was... there was the under manager at the pit. Big lump of a bloke, fancied himself could fight a bit, you know. And he was down there half pissed. And one of our blokes, bloke named Gray, Ashley Gray, pretty tough looking customer too, Ashley. Wasn't all that tall, but he was, you know, well built. Anyhow, he gave Ashley a hiding because Ashley was pissed as a parrot. Anyhow, Ashley lined him up one day. We got down there. He never had a, wouldn't only had a couple of drinks before this big bastard got down there. And he said, "Right on now, Beaumont, you arsehole. Let's see if you can do the same as you did the other day when I was pissed." "Get out, you know, I'll do you no trouble at all. Well, now's your bloody chance. You can give me another hiding if you..." "What do you give fucking Beaumont a hiding?" And he actually knocked him down, and Beaumont said, "That's enough. That's enough. I've had enough." He said, "You haven't had half enough yet. I'm coming down there with you." So he lay down beside him and hammered him again. Some bloody characters in the bloody minds, I tell you.
Yeah. How'd you come by your name, Digger?
Oh, a bit of a story attached to it. It was my parents that gave it to me. But I never knew any other name. My parents never called me anything else. My brothers and sister never called me anything else. I had a few aunts when we came back from Collinsville, and I got to know them. They were my aunties. There were a couple of them that called me Charles, you know. Couple of dad's sisters that called me Charles. But I was born in 1919. And that's when the soldiers were coming back from the First World War. And in uniform, you know. And of course, I was starting to toddle around the place by then. Starting to try to talk. Mum used to say to me, "You used to point your finger at the soldiers and say, 'Digger, Digger.'" And she said that was the first word that you ever spoke that we could understand, was Digger. So I was called Digger. That's how I got it. People never ever knew what my... In fact, I didn't know myself. I thought that was my name, you know. And until I came back down from Collinsville. And of course, I had to go to school, to Silkstone School. And I remember going there. And the headmaster said, "What's your name?" Oh, he was an old bastard too. I said, "Murphy." What's your first name? Digger. Your first name's not Digger. I said, no, my uncle was with, one of my brother was with me, that's right, the older brother. He said, his name's Charles.